The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I'm going to do a couple of things today. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that everybody knows this, but that last week, the voters in the state of Washington rejected 54% to 46% a proposal to legalize doctor-assisted suicide for the terminally ill. And remember, this was called Initiative 119, the Death with Dignity measure. I think it's going to happen someday, but this was rejected, and it would have been the first in the United States legally sanctioning assisted suicide by lethal injection of a deadly dose of pills, or a deadly dose of pills. This will be, I think, part of the subject of our discussion today. In fact, I know it will, because the Wenberg and a number of the other things that I want to bring to you go into this. There were a number of medical ethics decisions made last week at election time. For example, efforts to repeal homosexual rights ordinances were defeated in both St. Paul, Minnesota, and San Francisco, which, of course, are cities known for their tolerance of homosexuals. But measures to ensure homosexual rights failed in a couple of smaller communities. And in Washington state, residents are split on a measure to protect abortion rights, even if the Supreme Court overturns the Roe v. Wade decision. That's going to be a big battle if they do overturn it, which I would find surprising. But if they did overturn it, then the states will be deciding whether to continue to protect abortion rights despite that federal mandate. So there's going to be a lot of interesting battles coming up. It was 654,000 to 648,000. So that's 50.2% to 49.8%. That's what you call close.
But it was defeated, right?
Yeah. You wonder about democracy in those circumstances, don't you? You know, is it possible that 0.2% of the people are right? The supporters of this Death with Dignity initiative include the Hemlock Society, various AIDS groups, the Gray Panthers, and the State Democratic Party of Washington, and some doctors. They all called it a long overdue right, offering a reprieve to the terminally ill, but others, of course, the opponents said that the initiative threatened the traditional pact between patient and doctor and would have created a new class of permissible killing. And that's, of course, what we're going to discuss with the Wenberg here. Now, I'd like to discuss Wenberg, if we could. We're in the last section of the book on legalizing voluntary active euthanasia. As you know, he sets up the issue by saying on page 180 and top of 181, it seems that we do not have a right to be killed if by that we mean that we can insist as a matter of right that others kill us, willing or not. Surely others would be within their rights in rejecting our request to be killed, which would not be the case if such a request were in fact backed up by a legitimate moral right. And then he quotes Peter Williams in a book that discusses the rights of the innocent. And he says, one cannot give a priest a handgun and demand that the priest use it. One might ask or beg or plead to get shot with a gun or a hypodermic needle, but not as an assertion of a right. Remember the biblical case we looked at last week or 2 weeks ago, Saul asking his armor bearer to do him in. Thus, he says, as a matter of religious or moral principle, I might refuse to accede to a patient's request to be killed, and I would be acting well within my moral rights. Indeed, to coerce me into acceding to that request would appear to be a violation of my rights. All right, that's one dimension of the issue. Okay, is that, how do we look at that dimension of the issue? Is this a ethically determinative matter that the right of the person to kill or not to kill has to be respected as well as the person who's asking for the thing? In other words, is this a legitimate moral consideration? I think that is a parallel, actually, yeah. You can't make somebody terminate a life. I suppose it's more complicated than that, because if the state has laws that that authorize the killing of a person in the case of a heinous crime, capital punishment, the henchman, or whatever you want to call him, is in a position to do the procedure. And I mean, in a way it's his job. In another way, I suppose he could refuse to be hired for that sort of purpose. In other societies, you can't refuse such a thing. You are hired and you do it, whether you agree or not that this person ought to be killed. There's a lot more to it, of course. That's, I think, an important part of the question of making voluntary active euthanasia legal. What is his basic view? Were you able to pick that up? There's a lot of material here, but were you able to pick up what his basic view is? Is he for it or against it? And how does he argue? How does he come out? Do you all recall that? He takes you through a lot of territory. What are some of the things that could happen? And notice how careful he is to avoid scary, slippery slope arguments. Yet he, as you say quite rightly, he comes out against it for the very reason that it would draw in too many other ambiguities. What are some of them?
Mm-hmm. Not
yeah. And also, what about a patient who changes his mind, or might have changed his mind had he not been in a coma and so on? That he raises that. He has a term, consensual homicide, which is, he considers it homicide just the same. He says that the law does not permit killing, this is on page 185, the law does not permit killing even when all of the following conditions are fulfilled. A, the individual to be killed both wants and requests to be killed. B, the person doing the killing does so willingly. And C, no third-party rights are violated. Now, can you think of examples of consensual homicide in that are not simply the doctor giving you an overdose? I mean, we don't do this much anymore, but in ancient societies and in some modern societies in other hemispheres, dueling is permissible. Of course, in some cults, you have human sacrifice. There are variations on this, but there are games where death is permissible and so forth. And so he says all of those forms of consensual suicide fulfill these conditions, yet since each homicide ought not to be legalized, he says, then it follows that these conditions by themselves are not sufficient to warrant the legalizing of consensual homicide, including euthanasia. All right, that's one of his major arguments. The argument also that he uses is that euthanasia doesn't harm anyone, whereas the acts of consensual homicide do. And he dismisses that difference because of the fear of the overall consequences coming in the wake of legalization. I had a small quarrel with that point. I don't know what he means by euthanasia doesn't harm anyone. It's meant to help the person, whereas a person killed in a duel is not benefited but harmed. I find such distinctions myself a little arbitrary, depending on what you mean by harm. You know, a person can simply have a wrong theology of life and can want to be done away with. And that person may think that it's for their greater good. And even everybody else may think it's for their greater good. But it isn't. It's harmful to if you have a certain theology of life. And then, of course, it's awkward to bring this up, but if a person's not a Christian, the afterlife for that person is not exactly beneficial. So, I don't know. I find... The saying that euthanasia doesn't harm anyone a little bit facile. And he seems to think that even... Now, he's against the legalization, but for different reasons, you know, because he says if an action can promote the best interests of everyone involved and it doesn't violate anyone's rights. And to me, what's lacking there is a Christian morality of justice, a Christian concern for justice. And I think that we have in our Christian ethics become much too oriented towards individual rights. And now, to be sure, individual rights are crucial, but they have to be set in context, and the context is much bigger than that. The context involves your society's laws, which ought to be based not just on what might be good for a lot of individuals, but on general principles of justice. I don't want to get too far off the track with this, but when you hear arguments about capital punishment and you hear arguments about legalizing marijuana and this type of argument, very often people are limiting their argument to what works or what's helpful, rather than to what is just. Now, admittedly, justice requires a transcendental standard, and the transcendental standard has to be derived religiously. I mean, that's obvious. Countries which may be very far from Christian consensus are reluctant to have that kind of argument. But I don't see how you can avoid it at some level. So, I don't believe that Christians in government, for example, should simply plead natural theology as a way to have a point of contact with non-Christians. I think they should stick to their Christian guns, though they should work in an authentic and with integrity, not simply use the law as a preaching platform. But at some point they're going to have to say, I'm against this, not because it might or might not be harmful, but because it's unjust. It's unjust. In as you know, in ethics there are interminable debates about capital punishment, and the issue is often, does it warn would-be killers to have a to know that that's their punishment? Is it a deterrent, in other words? And you can stack up the statistics on both sides pretty well. There are some arguments that certain kinds of crime are less prevalent in states that have capital punishment. But then there's also the famous case of people who don't care. And you know, in England, they when they debated this, at the very speech where somebody might have been arguing for right in front of the gallows for capital punishment based on deterrence, pickpockets came on and pickpocketed the people listening to the speech, you know. So it just wasn't a deterrent for them. And the issue is not, finally, whether capital punishment works, but whether it's just or not. I don't want to get into that particular question right now, but it, at some point we have to say that. And I think he could have strengthened his argument here by doing more than just appealing to the dangers in the wake of legalization, though I quite agree with him that there are some of those dangers. Now, having said this, he's against most of the slippery slope arguments, and he's against the comparison with the Nazis. You saw that. He has three negative fallout arguments. Remember how he handled those? Argument number one, it's feared that voluntary euthanasia, once legalized, will increasingly lose its voluntary character. Okay, and then he goes into this in some detail, and over on page 189, he says, especially vulnerable would be the old and the institutionalized. To be sure, they have earlier signed a euthanasia directive, but that will not by itself guarantee that their eventual request for euthanasia will be an authentic expression of what they then want for themselves. Indeed, what people anticipate they want and what they do actually want when confronted by death are often two quite different things. This may happen because, as an unnamed former officer of no less an organization, the Euthanasia Society of America is reported to have admitted, very few incurables have or express the wish to die, however great their physical suffering may be. The will to live, the desire for life, is such an overwhelming force that pain and suffering become bearable. That's argument number one. Argument number two, these are these, you know, negative fallout arguments. In other words, undesirable consequences type arguments. Argument number two, in assessing the consequences of legalized active euthanasia, we also need to take into account those candidates for euthanasia whose lives would be impacted negatively, even though they themselves do not choose euthanasia. Okay, now who are those people? Well, he says that people who are resisting family pressure opt for euthanasia. People who are emotionally torn between guilt over not having chosen euthanasia and resentment towards those they view as trying to pressure them into electing euthanasia. They'll feel guilty because they see the benefits that euthanasia would give to them, and so on. Ultimately, he says, they resist this pressure and reject euthanasia, but by no means has the legal possibility of euthanasia eased their dying and contributed to their peace of mind. Quite the contrary. And so, you know, that one goes in that direction. Argument number three, it might be, euthanasia might be the answer to some very tough medical cases. Rather than focusing on the need for improved healthcare systems, improved treatment for pain, improved nursing and so on, instead we might feel that we already have, in the form of voluntary active euthanasia, the answer. All right, and then he goes through that. And so on. Argument number four, legalization of voluntary active euthanasia may engender additional and unnecessary fears and anxiety among the terminally ill. Number five, some doctors will be considerably less hesitant to inject fatal doses whenever they deem it appropriate to do so. euthanasia freelancing, he calls it, and so on. So he's generally quite, he's against the legalizing of it, but is suspicious of a misuse of the slippery slope arguments, even though he says there's a place for them, and even there's a place for them in the law. His basic argument then seems to be that you have the various conditions for killing a person. The individual to be killed both wants and requests to be killed. The person doing the killing does so voluntarily. No third party rights are violated. And the killing is in the best interest of all concerned. But, he said, for those very reasons, when those are fulfilled, he's worried about what will happen if we legalize euthanasia. Are there any remarks or questions about Wenberg's presentation here? I'm going to give you actually some laws in a minute about self-determination and so on. But does anybody want to discuss his particular arguments? I saw a program on French television when we were living over there about eugenics. Well, it was basically about genetic engineering. And the same kind of arguments came up here. Most people were favorable to it, except for people like Elie Wiesel, who was on the satellite. And he said, well, I guess scientifically it's okay, but my problem with it is that I saw what it led to in the Nazi era. And he brings up the Nazi thing, and he considers it partly relevant, but not entirely. He says that what it should teach us is that we should value an open society in which ideas are debated. And that wasn't the case in Nazi Germany. But he says once the euthanasia program becomes public knowledge, then there's less cry of protest and outrage. And in an open and democratic society, one would trust it that the program never would have gotten off the ground in the first place. So he says, you know, the lesson of Nazi Germany is that you need to have... The rationale for euthanasia by the Nazis was to some degree financial, but to a great deal degree it was ideological. And he hopes that in a democracy that could never happen. I guess I am not as optimistic as he is. I think that the discussions out there in the state of Washington show that people are, though they're hardly going to go at it for some sort of ideological reason in that crude sense of anti-Semitism, they could be driven by an extreme form of humanism that says, I've got the right over my life. I can decide when to terminate it. I can decide what's easy and what isn't for my family. And this overemphasis on human rights can lead to this sort of carelessness about euthanasia. And as I say, as he says, once the program is there, it's very hard to get out of, because you have a lot of people who kind of emotionally are comfortable with that freedom and that autonomy, and I think it's not a good thing. Yeah.
Doors open
to less noble
right.
uses, right? Yeah, and I think as far as it goes, it's true. I just wish, I mean, this fellow's a Christian, I just wish he had used more biblical arguments for the sanctity of life, you know. That's one of the wonderful things about a law-ordered society. As long as the law isn't above God or something, the law is objective enough so that you don't have to agonize over every single thing, you know. When I stop at a stoplight, I don't agonize over, you know, whether it should be long or short or not there. Sometimes I get frustrated, but I don't agonize over it. The same with, you know, the suicide laws. I think I've told you this already, as you know, anyway, it's against the law to commit suicide. that means that attempted suicide cases always have to be resuscitated. The doctor has no choice. He can't sympathize or agonize, or maybe, you know, it'd be better, maybe it wouldn't. The law says, get this guy back, or get this girl back. And it helps in that case to have such a clear-cut law. The law doesn't cover everything in life, of course. There's a lot of gray areas that it can't cover. Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and that's something that I think every Christian in every vocation that's part of the world has to wrestle with, but it's particularly difficult in politics and in some roles. I mean, if you're a businessman and you're selling, you know, brooms, you may get onto some ethical principles here and there, but basically you're trying to sell brooms and do a good job, and you're just not going to get into a lot of transcendental discussions with your team. However, in government, you do. And my answer is, now here's where my present thinking is, and I realize that there's a lot of work to be done, but my answer is that the Christian believes in the legal prescriptions that he or she thinks are faithful to the principles of justice for biblical reasons. That's the Christian's position. The Christian's strategy may involve using all kinds of material which is sometimes directly related to biblical authority, sometimes only indirectly related. And what I mean by that is that I have no objections for a Christian politician to quote scripture as a reason for doing certain things, but I don't think it's strategically a good idea to do it all the time and to do it awkwardly, as if there was some restriction in the Bible to quote it all the time. I think a Christian can promote biblical principles by appealing to many things that are biblical, but that you just don't quote the Bible. So one of them, of course, is just what Wenberg does, is the slippery slope type of thing, is a legitimate Christian concern, because it's a biblical argument. If you read the Bible, you'll find that there's a lot of slippery slope arguments in the Bible. And Wenberg points out that they're even in the law. So a Christian in good conscience can appeal to these negative factors, the slippery slope argument, and he knows that he's doing it for biblical reasons, but he doesn't always have to quote the Bible. Now, see, that position is different from two others. It's different, on the one hand, from the theonomy view, which is that you always need to simply apply the law of God, and if people disagree with you, they're just simply wrong, and they ought to be ousted, and you ought to, you know, you ought to just sort of get back to the law of Moses. But it's also different from the pure pluralism of some Christians, of saying that, you know, in church I'm a Christian, but in government I'm a pluralist, because, you know, you gotta live with each other and do the best you can. Because, see, I think that's a schizophrenia that a Christian can't live with. A Christian should not be less Christian in his public life than in church life. It's just that there are strategic opportunities when you would quote the Bible, and others where you just wouldn't have to do that, but you could still stand for the same view. And if somebody called you to the mat on it, then you'd say, yeah, well, I believe this because of God. But you don't always have to bring God's name in, and some cultures will be more comfortable with that, so others will not. You know, American culture up until recently has been fairly open to arguments based on God. It's getting to a place where that's not going to be true so much anymore. Yeah. See, I find that odd. It's either right or wrong. And if it's wrong, then it's politically wrong as well as personally wrong. Now, the word impose is a trap, which I think is to be avoided. A lot of people object to Christians standing for Christian principles in government because they consider that it's imposing a view. Well, the connotation of impose is, you know, like have a Khomeini in there who legislates the latest thing he's received from God by coercion. Now, that of course is absurd, and Christians don't believe that that's their role. But if you mean by impose, argue for, seek to persuade about, then a certain kind of imposition is fine. That's all we can do. I mean, that's what politicians are imposing all the time in that way. They get up on a soapbox and they say, here's what we believe, and here's why I'm for, you know, national health, or here's why I'm for capital punishment, or whatever it might be. So I think that position of Cuomo's is a kind of schizophrenic position. Though, I sympathize. I know what he's trying to do. He's trying to say, look, I have all these strong beliefs, but, you know, we're living in a plural society. That's true as far as it goes. But a plural society should function better, as well as be a just society, if it's consistent with your Christian principles. It also doesn't mean that you can legislate everything. The Bible itself, in the church age, does not allow us to legislate confession. Doesn't encourage us to legislate confession. That's to be done through verbal, moral persuasion. The church can legislate confession. It has discipline. But the state is not, that's not the state's job. The state's job is to promote justice in society. It's not unrelated to confession, but it's not a direct legislation of confession. All right. Let's spend a little time on the legislation about self-determination. I promised you I would do that. I'd like to begin with some descriptions of the elective use of life-sustaining treatments in internal medicine. And much of the material that I'm going to use here comes from various medical journals and legal journals, and it's part of the ongoing study of what the law and what morality and what self-determination need to tell us in order to come to a healthy society. As you know, and I think I told you this last time, the Patient Self-Determination Act, sponsored by Danforth and Moynihan, it becomes effective December 1st, 1991, in a couple of weeks. This federal legislation brings advanced directives to public awareness. It applies to all healthcare institutions, hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and so on. And any HMO programs receiving Medicare or Medicaid. And it requires that all individuals receiving medical care must be given written information about their rights under state law to make decisions about medical care. And this includes the right to accept or refuse medical or surgical treatments. They also must be given information about their rights to formulate advanced directives, such as the living wills and durable power of attorney for healthcare. And institutions must prepare written policies to allow individuals to exercise these rights, and will be responsible for documenting in each individual's medical record whether he or she has executed such an advanced directive. It will not have to force the person to do so. It just has to say whether they have. Increasing access to information about legal opinions in choosing and refusing medical or surgical treatment, the law does not require individuals to decide. The law specifically states that facilities may not condition the provision of care or otherwise discriminate against an individual based on whether or not the person has executed an advance directive. This is a bit like the current debates over abortion counseling. There was a decision that you can't, federally funded abortion clinics cannot counsel. And the concern there was not, I think, because a desperate woman coming in shouldn't have some advice, but the concern was not to push that woman to having an abortion when she isn't able to think about it very clearly. And it's the same here. And as I told you, I think last time, the actual substance of the law is a matter for each state to determine. And this is very difficult because there are a lot of things that have come up, and I suspect that many of the states will not meet the deadline, or if they do, it'll be in a very, very cursory form, and we'll continue long after to debate, you know, how to implement this. But in any case, the written description of state laws will be developed at the state level, or through state agencies, and so on. Now, the new law does not override any state law which would allow a healthcare provider to object on the basis of conscience to implementing an advanced directive. So it doesn't change that. The written information required by the law has to be given out by hospitals at the time of admission. And at our hospital, we're trying to figure out what the best way to do that is. You know, do we just give them a pamphlet? What if it's an admission to the emergency room? You know, do you wake the person up for a second, say, you know, here's your rights, all right, knock them out again? Of course, that's silly, but it's not always simple to just know how to give the person their rights. The federal role in the implementing of the law is going to be probably informal. The Secretary of Health and Human Services is required to develop a national education campaign to inform the public of the opinion to execute advanced directives and of a patient's right to participate in and direct health care decisions. And the Secretary is also required to develop or approve national information that would be distributed by providers to inform the public about their rights. And the Secretary is also required to assist the states in developing the specific written information required in the Act. And finally, the Secretary is required to mail information to Social Security recipients and add a page to the Medicare handbook describing the new law. I actually have some of the pending changes that are going to be made in the Medicare handbook. So the information I'm giving you is comes out of that and comes out of a lot of other reflection. And there's a lot of it. I won't give you, you know, overwhelming detail, but there's a lot of very interesting parts to this. Now, the current focus on the elective use of life-sustaining medical treatment probably was stimulated more than anything else by the Quinlan case about 15 years ago. I remember in the 60s, there were individual people, including a friend of ours, who were pushing the living will and all that, but we regarded them as a little bit offbeat and fascinating folks and all, but and they had their own thing, had a cause. But of course now, it's not so strange after the Quinlan case. Quinlan's guardian, as you remember, was permitted by the New Jersey Supreme Court to authorize withdrawal of mechanical ventilation, even though the court acknowledged the probability that that would result in Karen and Quinlan's death. The roots of the Quinlan case go way back to the framers of the Constitution and even to the philosophers of the Enlightenment, if you will. Who has the right to decide over someone else's life and so on has been a part of the law of the West. It's not just something that suddenly had to be decided out of nothing. But the case's legacy extends to current medical practice and to contemporary patients and doctors. The Quinlan case is a kind of giant metaphor or giant symbol of the right of patients or their surrogates to choose or forgo life-sustaining medical treatment. Now, what is current thinking about the elective use of life-sustaining treatments? And let's talk about elective use rather than euthanasia, because it emphasizes that not everything that can be done for a patient must be done. Well, let me give you a couple of categories. First of all, DNR orders. DNR just means do not resuscitate. The best studied decision to forgo life-sustaining treatment is the DNR order. The incidence of DNR orders is 3 to 4% of all hospital admissions, and 5 to 14% of patients admitted to the intensive care unit. Conversely, 66 to 75% of hospital deaths and 39% of death in the intensive care unit, ICU, are preceded by a DNR order. Now, factors that you can associate with the writing of DNR orders include, of course, old age, or the increasing severity of an illness, poor pre-admission functional status, incontinence, abnormal mental status, or dementia, or all kinds of things. Of course, AIDS, the prognosis of survival. Recent surveys of elderly outpatients show that 77% to 82% would want CPR in their current health state, but only 21 to 38% would want CPR if they had severe dementia, stroke, irreversible coma, or terminal cancer. With respect to the process of DNR decision making, the studies show that the patient may only be involved in a minority of cases, estimates ranging from 14 to 43%. Oh my. Okay. Well, let me do a little more of this, and then we'll have our break. Incompetency at the time of do not resuscitate is a major reason that patients don't participate. Of course, it appears that at the time patients are admitted to the hospital, they're often capable of making decisions, but they become incompetent in the hospital before a DNR order is discussed. In any case, this is the trend. This is where most people are do not resuscitate. Second, mechanical ventilation. According to P.A. Singer, there is no published data. There are no published data on the incidence of decisions to forgo mechanical ventilation in general internal medicine practice. A recent study of intensive care units found that life support was withheld from 1% and withdrawn from 5% of patients. Mechanical ventilation accounts for 23% of withheld and 83% of withdrawn life support therapies. What are the factors associated with this decision? A patient with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, the likelihood of survival is low. Prognosis, another interesting variant here is the physician's level of training. They found that residents are more likely to forgo mechanical ventilation than private practitioners. I don't know if that's the dollar raising its ugly head or whether that's because of more sophistication or something. One interesting survey showed that 55% of homosexual men with AIDS would want mechanical ventilation and a transfer to the intensive care. care. If required for the treatment of one of the kinds of pneumonia that you get from AIDS, or that is AIDS. However, here, I love these studies. This number dropped to 19% if the patient had both that pneumonia and severe memory loss. In other words, people don't want to be saved if they can't think. You know. Another interesting survey of patients showed that 90% of patients with all kinds of diagnoses wanted life support in their current state of health. 30% would want life support if they could, if they would be no longer independent when they got out. And very few wanted it despite a hopeless prognosis. Well, not very few. 16% wanted it despite hopeless prognosis, and so on. Now, there are many other scenarios here. Dialysis, antibiotic therapy, nutrition and hydration. This is one that we ought to mention, and I'll do that and we'll have a break. There are no empirical studies that document the incidence of decisions to forgo artificial nutrition or hydration. And this is, of course, surprising because it's been so much in the news. Factors associated with the decision to withhold artificial feeding include the patient's preference, their discomfort, their life expectancy, the family wishes, and so on. In one study, 41% of physicians believed that informed consent should be obtained for nasogastric feeding. However, doing a chart review shows that patient consent is documented as only 12% and surrogate consent an additional 14% of the cases of tube feeding. So this is a, it's very hard to read all of that material. On one survey, 75% of patients said they would not want to be fed by a tube if they had dementia, if they were demented. Interestingly enough, no data exists concerning the costs of decisions to forgo artificial nutrition and hydration. This doesn't, just hasn't been studied, but you can imagine it has been thought about a lot. Okay, why don't we stop there, and I'll give us a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back for more.